It's Friday, June 19th. We've got a massive morning to cover, starting with a major shift in the Middle East. We're also digging into the sudden regulatory freeze on advanced AI models, and what that means for the companies trying to navigate this high-friction environment. Plus, we'll look at why the sports and publishing industries are pivoting toward rent collector models just to keep the lights on. Here's the thing. It's a world of routine conflict, and the people winning aren't the ones waiting for the status quo to return. They're the ones who have already accepted that the status quo is dead. The United States and Iran have entered into a 14-point memorandum of understanding aimed at de-escalating the recent conflict. According to reports, the agreement mandates a 60-day ceasefire and the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, a move that triggered an immediate 2.5% drop in global crude oil prices. The deal includes provisions for the U.S. to begin lifting sanctions on Iranian oil, banking, and transport sectors, and describes the creation of a $350 billion reconstruction fund for Iran. While the administration says it won't contribute directly to that fund, the deal reportedly requires the U.S. to oversee its distribution. Here's the thing, this isn't a treaty, it's an executive memorandum. That means no congressional oversight, no formal ratification, and crucially, no guarantee that this policy survives the next 4 years. The administration is framing this as a victory for market stability and a way to avoid a global recession, but they've effectively traded long-term leverage for a very short-term breather. By conceding on domestic uranium enrichment and allowing Iran to keep its infrastructure intact, the White House has essentially walked back every red line they previously set. It's a classic punt strategy. They're extending the negotiation window in 60-day increments to avoid the political fallout of a formal treaty or a messy confrontation in Congress. But look, when you signal that you're willing to trade nuclear red lines for lower gas prices, you aren't just managing a crisis. You're teaching your adversary exactly how to squeeze you the next time they want a concession. And that reconstruction fund? It's a massive amount of cash that is inherently fungible. You can call it reconstruction all you want, but that money is going to flow right back into the state's regional power projection. The deal also reportedly requires a permanent end to military operations in Lebanon, which is currently a non-starter for the local security situation. If the U.S. can't actually enforce that withdrawal, the whole agreement falls apart. It's a precarious setup that seems designed to prioritize optics over reality. Right down to the administration's plan to use the nation's 250th anniversary as a political rally. When you start treating national milestones like campaign events and foreign policy like a series of 60-day stopgaps, you aren't building a stable future. You're just hoping the house doesn't catch fire while you're still on the clock. Section AI News. The U.S. government has suspended the release of Anthropic's most advanced AI models following reports of jailbreaks flagged by Amazon. The move has triggered a mandatory 30-day review process for any future model launches, a reality that is fundamentally altering how enterprises think about their AI stacks. Here's the thing, the timing is hard to ignore. Anthropic previously labeled these models as dangerous, which set a massive bar for their competitors. By releasing them and then having them pulled by the feds, they've essentially created a regulatory moat. They've established their older models as the market standard, while every other company in the space is now staring down a new 30-day bureaucratic hurdle that could kill their own product momentum. It's a pretty slick way to turn regulatory scrutiny into a competitive advantage. This has forced a massive pivot in how businesses actually build stuff. We're moving away from the monolithic era, where you just pay one big company for one big model, and toward what's being called compound routing architectures. Basically, the era of throwing the most expensive model at every single task is over, mostly because it's becoming too damn expensive. If you're running a chain of autonomous agents and every subtask is hitting a premium, frontier-level model, your margins are going to evaporate. So, developers are shifting to routing layers. These systems use lightweight, local models for the grunt work and only delegate to the frontier models when the task is actually difficult. Think of it like an office. You don't have your senior partner filing your expense reports. You have the junior associate do the routine stuff, and you only pull in the partner for the high-stakes negotiations. This shift is creating a few clear winners. First, Hardis Engineering is becoming the new gold standard. It's not just about the model anymore, it's about the orchestration, the memory, and the guardrails you build around the model. Companies that master this harness can get the same performance as a frontier model at a fraction of the cost. Second, we're seeing a decoupling of knowledge from reasoning. Recent industry developments show that you can maximize reasoning capabilities while keeping your static data in private, local databases. That's a huge deal for enterprises that are worried about government kill switches or access bans. If you keep your core knowledge on your own infrastructure, you're not as vulnerable to a vendor just pulling the plug or being forced to pull it. The bottom line is that the brute force approach to AI is reaching its limit. The loss of these latest models prove that the newest release isn't just a technical asset, it's a liability. If your entire workflow is tied to the latest, shiniest, most expensive toy, you're just one oops, that's a security risk away from a total system outage. At this point, the companies winning are the ones treating AI as a dynamic engineering problem, not a static procurement list. They're building their own operational harnesses, they're diversifying their model dependencies, and they're prioritizing stability over whoever happens to have the highest score on a benchmark test this week. The state of North American horse racing is effectively a tale of two industries. On one hand, you've got these marquee high-purse events, think Churchill Downs or the Arlington Million, that are consolidating power, pulling in the big money, and effectively starving the rest of the ecosystem. On the other hand, the daily product is struggling. We're seeing erratic field sizes, with races at places like Aqueduct and Woodbine dropping to 3 or 4 horses, which is a death knell for wagering interest. And it gets worse. Hawthorne is currently in bankruptcy, and if we see liquidation by mid-July, it's going to leave a massive hole in the Chicago market. It's a shitty situation, really. The industry is trying to dress up these massive, shiny race days to hide the fact that the foundation is crumbling. Regulatory friction isn't helping either. The Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Authority's 6-strike whip rule has become a point of total contention. You've got riders like Junior Alvarado racking up fines and suspensions. And for what? There's zero evidence that these rules are actually bringing new fans into the sport. It's coming across less like a genuine welfare initiative and more like a punitive revenue stream that's just alienating the people who actually make the races happen. If you're trying to handicap this mess, the old-school reliance on raw speed figures is becoming a liability. The current crop of 3-year-olds is racing less frequently than horses did 20 or 30 years ago, meaning they lack that deep physical foundation. When you look at a horse like Burnham Square, it's easy to get fooled by a slow early pace. If a horse is allowed to dictate the terms, they look unbeatable, but that's a tactical mirage. You aren't betting on a superior athlete, you're betting on a horse that got a lucky script. The smart money now is on tactical versatility. You have to look for horses that are mature enough to settle behind the field, rather than one-dimensional speedsters who fall apart when the pace gets real. The WNBA is expanding. Next season, the league will grow to 50 games as it adds 3 new franchises. This isn't just about more floor time, it's a pivot toward a star-centric model, leaning hard into the commercial power of individual athletes like Caitlin Clark, whose signature shoe launch is seen as a bellwether for the league's new, individual brand-driven revenue strategy. Meanwhile, the way we watch games is changing, and the Oakland A's new ballpark in Las Vegas is the blueprint. They're moving away from the fill-the-seats mentality, opting for a compact 9-acre site where 20% of the inventory is dedicated to premium seating. We're talking dugout suites designed to mimic the proximity of NBA floor seats. It's an aggressive play for high-yield hospitality, and honestly, it puts a hell of a lot of pressure on other teams to renovate or risk watching their corporate sponsors jump ship for a more exclusive view. NASCAR is taking a different route to stay relevant. They're hosting exhibition races on active military bases. The idea here isn't just to find a track, but to manufacture a destination experience that builds cultural capital. It's a smart move to drive ticket demand in a way that a standard, repetitive schedule just can't touch anymore. Fox Corporation is buying Roku. It's a move that officially signals a shift in the media landscape. The industry is betting that owning the pipe is safer than making the water. By acquiring the platform, Fox is stepping away from the high-stakes, high-cost gamble of original content production that has been draining the coffers at places like Disney. Instead, Fox is looking to control the gateway. With Roku's reach into 100 million households, they're positioning themselves as the ultimate aggregator. It's a smart, if cold, calculation. In a market where viewers are drowning in subscription fatigue and fragmented apps, the company that owns the remote, or in this case, the navigation interface, holds all the leverage. They aren't just selling shows anymore. They're selling the map. Which, honestly, is the only move that makes sense if you're trying to avoid the meat grinder of modern streaming. It's a shitty position to be in if you're a content creator, but for a legacy firm like Fox, it's a way to keep collecting checks from everyone else's subscription fees without having to bankroll the next prestige drama. Meanwhile, in the digital publishing world, Jay Penske is consolidating what's left of Vox Media's assets. This isn't about growth, and it certainly isn't about some grand vision for journalism. It's a defensive play for scale. By rolling dozens of niche properties into one giant portfolio, Penske is building a moat. The idea is that even if an individual brand doesn't have the teeth it did 10 years ago, the collective reach still gives them a stranglehold on specific advertising windows. Like the For Your Consideration campaigns that Hollywood loves to dump money into. They're also pivoting toward live events and high-affinity gatherings. They're trying to monetize community, because let's face it, traffic is a dying currency. They're terrified of AI, and they're hoping that if they can get people to actually show up in a room together, they can survive the inevitable contraction. It's a classic move. When the internet stops paying, start charging for the handshake. Then there's the planned integration of CBS News and CNN. They're essentially building a ghost kitchen for news, sharing back-end infrastructure to keep the lights on while the traditional business model continues to rot. It's a massive logistical nightmare. You're talking about merging international operations, balancing complex financial structures, and managing the bruised egos of two legacy newsrooms, all while trying to figure out how to be relevant in a digital-first world. Look, the takeaway here is pretty blunt. The old mantra that content is king is dead. It's been replaced by distribution is king. If you can control the platform, or if you can aggregate enough niche ad space to act as a gatekeeper, you've got a shot at survival. Everyone else? They're just waiting for the next round of cuts. It's a brutal, necessary consolidation. It's also entirely predictable. When the industry stops trying to inform or entertain, and starts focusing entirely on how to trap the viewer in a walled garden, you know the era of grand ambition is over. We're in the era of the rent collector now. That's the briefing for Friday, June 19th. Take a second to look past the headlines today. Most of what you're seeing is just noise designed to keep you from noticing the actual shifts happening underneath. We'll be back on Monday to see what's left of the house.